Merci Olivier. Bonsoir Mesdames et Messieurs. C'est un grand honneur d'être invité à Paris 2. Heureusement pour vous, je veux parler en français. En anglais. In his reflections on contemporary French philosophy, Alain Bourdieu begins, as all self-respecting French philosophers begin, with a paradox. The most universal, he claims, is also the most particular. This, of course, to the English is absolute nonsense. There is, though, a core of good sense in what he is saying, and the core of good sense is expressed in Hegel's idea of the concrete universal. By this he means that we invariably present a claim in universal terms, but it's a claim made at a particular time and a particular place. And we express it as though it's a universal, but it is in fact the reflection of a particular. This tension between the universal and the particular is one of the themes that I want to address in these three lectures. The universal I'm interested in concerns the search for scientific principles of constitutional ordering that can confer legitimacy on political regimes. The aspiration is distinctively modern. It arises when belief in divine or natural or traditional modes of ordering have dissipated, and in these circumstances, the argument is made that if there is a way of reconciling the need for order with the desire for liberty, then this can be made only through some type of rational analysis. This was the conviction of many of those in the intellectual movement that is invariably known as the European Enlightenment. And in various ways, the scholars of the European Enlightenment sought to reveal what Rousseau called les principes du droit politique. The European Enlightenment project of discovering scientific principles of constitutional ordering is one of a specific time and a specific place. But it also made universal claims, and I want to pay particular attention to two of these claims. The search for universal principles led scholars to a distinctive way of conceiving the world. It led to the formation of what one might call the autonomous concept of the political. Living in a world of considerable economic, social, and technological, as well as political change, Enlightenment scholars saw the political as a domain of thought and action. It's a special type of domain, it's distinct from the economic and social power networks that were shaping modern societies. The specification of the political as an autonomous way of conceiving the world is the first and most important and most basic achievement of that movement. The second universalizing tendency involves the recognition that this world-making capacity must be expressed in the language of law. The imaginative power of the autonomous worldview is released only when the political domain is conceived in legal terms. Certainly, jurists were drawn into offering competing accounts of political ordering, which involved specific conceptions of authority, liberty, equality, right, solidarity, and so forth. The essential point is that irrespective of their precise argument and irrespective of the precise details of their claim, these claims could only be presented in the language of right and law. I've suggested that the autonomy of the political is a modern idea. It is the achievement of a group of Enlightenment scholars seeking to specify the legitimating principles of modern society. I've also suggested that the case for specifying these legitimate principles could only be expressed in legal language. These two assertions can be combined to make a derivative claim that the assertion of the autonomy of the political can be sustained only when it's simultaneously generating an autonomous conception of legality. And I think that these moves bring about a radical shift in thought. The shift takes place at a particular moment in time and within a particular place in the world, but it has the potential to assume a universal significance. The nature of human collective existence is explained as a set of political relations expressed in the language of rights and obligations. The overall purpose of this type of inquiry is to specify the fundamental laws of political power and to offer an account of their nature. These fundamental laws have been given a variety of names, including jus politicum and les principes du droit politique. And the general field of scholarly inquiry that defines the search for these fundamental laws is what I am calling here political jurisprudence. Political jurisprudence flourishes as a distinctive type of scholarly inquiry only when the intrinsic connection between the legal and the political is acknowledged. And this is so because the political presents itself as a world without limitation. Such limits as are revealed by the political way of viewing the world can be revealed only by discerning its fundamental laws. That is, by bringing the principles and practices of political right, of droit politique, into some form of structural relationship. And the recognition of such a structural relation, that is, a constitutional arrangement, a constitutional form, is essential to the purposes of building up the power of this worldview. The topic of political jurisprudence is particularly complicated because of the need to bring the legal and the political into some type of relationship. The problem here is that both of these phenomena are highly contested, and they are commonly regarded as being antagonistic to one another. Attempts to specify a structural relationship between the two are likely to be discredited both by political scientists and by jurists. Political scientists might contest the claim that the political domain is legally ordered. Similarly, lawyers might reject the converse formulation, namely that the legal domain is politically ordered. The claim underpinning political jurisprudence is that the legal and the political must be conceived as existing in a symbiotic relationship. The political and the legal are often regarded as belonging to two different registers of thought. The former, the political, concerning the struggle over human interests, is a material phenomenon or an empirical phenomenon, whereas the latter, the legal is often regarded as being belonging to a normative realm. So let me address this point immediately. When the claim is made that the political is an autonomous way of looking at the world, the criterion of the political must be distinguished from the practices of politics. We distinguish this in French between the distinction between le politique and la politique. La politique, of course, is more commonly used for politics, the practices within a regime. Certain French philosophers bring in to the French language the notion of le politique, the ground, the basis on which a distinctive way of looking at the world through a political point of view can be discerned. The former, the ground, arises because the formation as a matter of historical fact of particular groups as into a particular type of association. And that group, that collective human group, might have no intrinsic value, no intrinsic normative basis for its existence, other than what is needed to sustain its existence in the world. This was the central point of Carl Schmitt's argument that the autonomy of the political rests on an inclusionary-exclusionary distinction, what he called the distinction between friend and enemy. So I think Schmitt was right in his basic understanding of that distinction. But that just takes us to the first stage. The criterion of the political rests ultimately on an existential condition. But although the origins may lie in specific existential expressions of insecurity, such as the threat of war or the breakdown of civil peace, the association is able to preserve this sense of unity and to build on this sense of unity only through the formation of institutions that represent a common will. The political is able to maintain its distinctive way of viewing the world only through the production of certain common meanings, certain common understandings, certain common practices, and certain common norms. And this means that the political is able to strengthen the authority of its own distinctive worldview only through the medium of right and law. It's therefore too simple to state that the political is an empirical phenomenon. It's also too simple to say that the legal is a purely normative phenomenon. Law is a product of the monopolization of the legitimate use of physical force in a given territory. That's the modern understanding of law. Law is the expression of the will of a ruling power. So if that is so, then law is also an empirical phenomenon, a set of commands of an established ruler. Now, many jurists would contest such a positivist conception of law. They would argue that law is not simply derived from an existing power. It is an autonomous and universal phenomenon with its own intrinsic qualities of generality, prospectivity, proportionality, and such like. This may be correct, but many jurists go too far in claiming that law has an autonomous and universal normative quality. The crucial point is that although political unity is strengthened by law, law must be protected by the political monopoly of force. Without the force, the normative is irrelevant. This requirement renders the universal aspiration subservient to particular circumstances. Following on from this, I should in addition highlight a conceptual distinction between positive law, the law enacted by the sovereign lawmaking authority, and the fundamental law of political ordering. If by law we mean positive law, then it might be conceived to be an instrument of the ruling authority. But Enlightenment scholars were seeking something deeper. The conditions, the precepts, the practices, the norms that establish and maintain the right ordering of a regime. Law, in this understanding, is not an instrument of an extant power. It is the medium through which the power is able to maintain its authority. These different conceptions of the political and the legal must be borne in mind when we try to understand political jurisprudence. But behind this distinction lie two different concepts of power. The existential idea of the political and the concept of positive law give rise to a concept of power as an ability to achieve intended effects. And this is what I would call power as potentia, to use the old Latin formulation. But the concept of political law, political right, rests on the power that is generated by living together as a collective entity. And this is a different type of, this different conception of power. Again, to differentiate it, I use the Latin potestas. I'll return to this distinction later. All I should say for the moment is that the type of power I mean by potestas has the specific function of strengthening the authority of the political point of view. That is as abstract as I will get. That is fairly abstract, very dense, very difficult for me in English. The French are used to dealing with abstractions, not me. In these lectures, I want to explain the importance of political jurisprudence by paying particular attention to three basic concepts: concepts of state, sovereignty, and constitution. These, I think, are the fundamental building blocks of political jurisprudence. Secondly, I want to examine this universal aspiration to develop scientific principles of ordering by focusing on a particular expression of it. Specifically, I want to consider only the contribution that French scholars have made to the formation of this subject. And I want to look at them in terms of the formative period between the 16th and 18th century today, the period, the immediate post-revolutionary and post-revolutionary period next week, and then finally to look at the last 150 years in one sweeping lecture next Friday. The French stand second to none in the contribution they have made to the subject of political jurisprudence, so this is not a critical exercise of exposing deficiencies in thought. I focus on the French experience because I think it highlights very well not just the building of this concept, but also the difficulties we have in sustaining it in the world today. So first I should enter a couple of caveats. In trying to cover such a rich subject in three lectures, I will of necessity sketch in broad terms, and I want to focus on the work of particular scholars. I'll only get any depth by focusing on certain individuals. Secondly, I claim no expertise in the French literature. I must therefore tenter my chance. And I hope you will be able to provide me with some feedback on some of the evaluations I'm making on some of these French jurists. Anyway, in the remainder of this first lecture, I want to focus on the pioneering role of three French scholars, Bodin, Montesquieu, and Rousseau. I want to show how their work centers on the necessity of establishing what I've been calling the autonomy of the political. And thirdly, I want to indicate how this is manifest in their treatment of these foundational concepts, especially of the first two, of state and sovereignty. The issue of constitution I want to leave to the next lecture. The constitutional problem is the problem, from my perspective, of the French Revolution. So let me move on immediately to Bodin. Bodin's great achievement is to have recognized with singular clarity a fundamental truth. And that truth is that the nation becomes a political unity only through an imaginative exercise of conceiving itself as a state. He then explains the essential criterion of being able to conceive itself as a state, and that essential criterion is that it possesses the quality of absolute collective authority. This is what Bodin calls sovereignty. Sovereignty is a term that is now forever associated with Bodin. But I want to emphasize an aspect of his account that I think is in danger of being overlooked. His argument about sovereignty reveals something deeper still. Sovereignty does not just involve the need to establish some ultimate central authority. It is the necessary precondition for recognizing the autonomy of the political. Bodin not only acknowledged this point, he went on to claim that to strengthen the authority of this distinctive worldview, the autonomous domain of the political must be configured through law. He presents his thesis systematically in 1576 in his monumental study, Six Livres de la République. This work is the foundational study of the emerging modern practice of political jurisprudence. Scholars have offered a variety of views about Bodin's originality. Some have located it in his argument that to understand the nature of the state, there must be some supreme center of authority that incorporates all governmental power. This is the origin of the claim that law is an expression of the will of the sovereign. Others see originality embodied in his argument that the sovereign possesses unlimited freedom to act free from the constraints of law. They therefore see Baudin important primarily as a theorist of absolutism. Others again have argued that his rebuttal of the right of resistance to sovereign authority demonstrates his antipathy to constitutional schemes that entail checks and balances. But none of these, I think, reveal the true character of Baudin's genius. Baudin's singular achievement is to have laid the platform for an autonomous worldview in which we conceive of collective human existence in politico-legal terms. To do so, he retrieved the ancient Greek distinction between the household and the polity, between the private and the public, between the material world based on hierarchy, based on master and slave, or superior and inferior, and a public world, a political world, involving governing arrangements that, in the absence of belief in divine or natural ordering, could only be constituted as an expression of human will, a human will to live together. This involved an exercise in imagination that projected the political as a distinctive worldview. In 1576, for understandable pressing political reasons in France at the time, Baudin had to emphasize the importance of establishing a supreme center of authority. But he was, I believe, much more concerned to explain the nature, significance, and function of the concept of sovereignty than to specify who actually exercised the power of the office of the sovereign. Crucial to this exercise is Baudin's distinction between sovereignty and government. This distinction is often overlooked, but it is explicit there in the six books. In the first book, Baudin explains that every state must possess a supreme, ultimate, sovereign authority. This is the source of those governmental powers that all sovereign states must possess. These powers may be exercised by various magistrates, officers, bodies, but they ultimately belong to the office of the sovereign. The sovereign, he recognizes, might be either the prince or the people. But sovereignty itself is asserted to be absolute, perpetual, indivisible. It is absolute, perpetual, and indivisible because he's opening up a distinctive way of looking at the world. Government, by its nature, is conditional, it's limited, it's divisible. Sovereignty is conceptual. Government is empirical. Sovereignty is constitutive of the conceptual exercise of thinking about the legitimacy of modern practices of governing. The question of who exercises the sovereign power is a merely regulative question. In books 2 to 6, Baudin analyzes the main forms of government that have emerged in history. His purpose is to try to devise empirical conclusions, prudential maxims about those practices of governments that either strengthen or weaken the state. But it's evident that his overall purpose is juridical. It's to try and to specify the fundamental laws at work in the public realm. Book one specifies the constitutive rule, sovereignty, absolute, perpetual, distinctive way of looking at the world. Books 2 to 6 lay down the regulative rules of how you build and lose authority within that worldview. What I'm suggesting, I'm jumping ahead of my text. What I'm suggesting then is that Baudin achieved a remarkable innovation, more important than simply providing a modern expression of a doctrine of sovereignty. He demonstrated first that the political can be asserted as an autonomous domain, and that autonomous domain is founded on the concept that we call the state. And thirdly, that this state possesses a quality that we call sovereignty. And then Baudin goes on to show, fourthly, that this sovereign state provides a symbol of political unity. And that symbol of political unity was needed to sustain the authority of its governing institutions. And fifthly, that these institutions needed to be adequately equilibrated. Baudin talks about the need for harmonic proportion amongst the institutions of government in order to be able to bolster their authority, in order to be able to strengthen this way of looking at the world, of looking at human will collectively organizing itself through this worldview. Baudin may have provided us with a modern definition of law as the will of the sovereign. But through his studies of the governmental forms in books 2 to 6, he also provides us with a blueprint of the fundamental laws of the political domain. These are neither causal laws of the natural sciences, nor the divine laws of a revelatory God. They are the distillation of the practices of right ordering of the state, les principes du droit politique. The constitutional arrangements that are conducive to sustaining and promoting the sovereign authority of that state. Now, it's tempting to say, the more I read Baudin, and it's not an easy read, but the more I read Baudin, the more I'm tempted to say that the subsequent development of political jurisprudence is little more than a footnote to Baudin. It was remarkable. But I need to move on, and so let me show in the time remaining how Baudin exercises this influence on two other great French scholars of political jurisprudence, two 18th century French scholars of political jurisprudence, Montesquieu and Rousseau. Lawyers today generally praise Montesquieu as the inventor of some doctrine called the separation of powers. This is how he's faded in the Anglo-American world. From the perspective of political jurisprudence, however, that contribution doesn't seem to be especially original or profound. By the mid-18th century, the importance of dividing governmental tasks for the purposes of reconciling order and liberty was pretty well understood. This, though, is not to underestimate Montesquieu's achievements. His work is of the first importance, but I want to focus on aspects of that work that remain relatively understated. To see the importance of Montesquieu's contribution to political jurisprudence, we need to focus directly on how Montesquieu conceptualizes the political and the state. And these are the building blocks of what he's doing, but he says very little about them. But they're there, I think, in the spirit of the laws. Political philosophers of his era generally built their theories from first principles by invoking the imagery of the social contract. This technique had the benefit of avoiding theological speculation or complex historical inquiry. Montesquieu does not adopt this approach. Rather than trying to resolve the question of origins through the device of some virtual social contract, he derived his conclusions empirically from what he calls the nature of things. This was a highly demanding exercise. On the basis of his historical inquiries, he claimed, contrary to Hobbes, that the state of nature does not constitute a state of war. The idea of a state of war arises only once societies have already been formed. It's only when people enter into society that they feel the will to power. And it is this power impulse that produces the state of war. Far from being a condition that necessitates the formation of society, war, says Montesquieu, is a product of its formation. The great significance of this point is that it enables Montesquieu to maintain that it is the existence of the threat of war within societies and between societies that establishes the need for law. Montesquieu explains that laws come into existence to regulate three main types of social relations: civil right, concerning the relations between citizens, political right, concerning the relations between governors and governed, and the right of nations, concerning relations between states. These then are drawn together through a union, these relations are drawn together through a union of wills. This union of wills is what Montesquieu refers to as the institution of the state. Having established his formation of the state, he then turns to his major task to specify the spirit of the laws made within the institution of the state. This was the ambition of his great work on the spirit of the laws. The aim of this work was not to classify the laws made by particular political regimes. These, the positive laws, are merely the products of that regime. Rather, his aim was to discern the laws that have shaped the formation of these regimes. These are the fundamental laws of the political domain. So here his ambition is to generate nothing less than an entirely new concept of law. Before l'esprit des lois, law was conceived as command. whether this was the product of the will of a divine creator, God's command, or whether, when Baudin broke with the cosmic imagery of the medieval world, the command of the sovereign. Montesquieu claimed that instead, that law is not command, it's an expression of what he calls the necessary relations arising from the nature of things. The significance of this insight emerges with his claim that each type of order operates according to its own fundamental laws. The laws of the physical world are different to the laws that regulate human interaction. But even within human conduct, there are different ways and different modes of interaction. Montesquieu says, not all political vices are moral vices, and not all moral vices are political vices. And those who make the laws that run counter to the general spirit should not be ignorant of this. What he's saying is that the political world is distinct from the moral world. It operates in accordance with its own laws. With this observation, we register the point that Montesquieu's monumental inquiry entails a search for the fundamental laws that maintain the autonomy, the authority of a distinctively political way of looking at the world. It has been shown by a number of French scholars, Eisenman, Troper, and others, that Montesquieu's so-called doctrine of the separation of powers entails no strict separation. It involves the blending or balancing of the powers of government. This undoubtedly is correct. All I would add is that when we look at his work from the perspective of political jurisprudence, his objective is not to demonstrate the importance of curtailing political power by law. It is to demonstrate that in order to generate political power, the political must be framed by the legal. It's a power-building way of looking at the world. Laws build authority. Government, according to law, is not limiting government, it's strengthening the authority of government, governing. It's strengthening a particular way of looking at the world. And Montesquieu finally recognizes that in order to be able to generate that type of authority, the type of authority that's needed to govern modern societies, the governmental forms of modern societies must display a degree of institutional complexity. Modern government is too complicated, too varied, too heterogeneous to be able to be run by a single sovereign, a dictator. Of necessity, it builds its strength only through institutional differentiation. Let me leave Montesquieu for the moment and come now to the third and last great French scholar of the formative period, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau takes a different approach to the nature of the task than Baudin and Montesquieu. Unlike them, he doesn't seek to distill the principles of political right from some historical investigation into the practices of governing. On the contrary, Rousseau argues that a political jurisprudence drawn from a study of history is likely only to replicate historical injustices and established power formations. Rousseau recognizes that if by law we mean simply the will of the sovereign, then a study of law can never yield the principles of legitimate political order. And he contends that the political cannot simply be derived from the desire to achieve order and provide security, contrary to Hobbes. Rather than engaging in an historical inquiry and discovering the origins of political order in war or insecurity, Rousseau takes a different tack altogether. He begins by trying to identify the principles of legitimate political order, only later reflecting on how, once we've discovered these legitimating principles, they might be put to work in practice. How, he asks, can we transform law from being an instrument that bolsters the hierarchical relationship of sovereign and subject, and transform it into a medium by which liberty and equality can be realized? Some scholars have argued that Rousseau's aim is to make the legal and the political subservient to the social, and that far from providing an account of the political as an autonomous domain, he seeks the eclipse of the political. I don't think this is correct. I wouldn't, given my project, think it's correct. He may be seeking an escape from history, but his objective is not to make the political the handmaiden of the social. Rather, I think his aim is to specify how an autonomous conception of the political can be presented in rational, in logical terms. Rousseau argues that Hobbes made an error. He made an error in treating the foundational pact, that social contract, as a trade-off between liberty, the absence of constraint, and law, the will of the sovereign. And Hobbes is saying, we give up our liberty for the security and protection of the laws of the conferred by the sovereign. Rousseau, by contrast, argues that the modern state is legitimated only when, in that foundational moment, a lower type of liberty is supplanted by liberty of a higher type. That is, only when natural liberty is replaced by political liberty. Liberty, for Rousseau, does not mean the mere absence of constraint. Liberty entails self-government. So liberty, for Rousseau, is not opposed to law. It is possible to reconcile liberty and law by establishing a state in which people live under laws that they themselves have made. This claim makes the concept of political right the key to understanding legitimate government. The question then arises, how can political right, reconcile freedom with government. Rousseau then tries to demonstrate how this might be so. He argues that the sovereign, created as a result of that foundational pact, that social contract, cannot be a single person, and it cannot be a representative office. It must be the people as a collective entity. The sovereign, he says, is the public person formed by the union of all. That is, the sovereign is the state. How then can this public person of the state be said to have a single will? Rousseau answers that in two stages. First, he argues that the foundational pact substitutes a political equality for whatever physical inequality nature may have established. Unequal in nature, individuals become political equals only by virtue of the pact. Some of us are stronger than others. Some of us have more charismatic power than others. Some of us are more intelligent than others. We live in a world of natural inequality. Rousseau is saying we conceive ourselves to be equal only once we adopt the political world view. We conceive ourselves to be political and therefore also legal equals. But we can only do that by virtue of this rational exercise. Only as equals do a multitude become transformed into a people. Secondly, he says that this political equality becomes the precondition for the formation of a single will. That is, each citizen acquires the same rights over the others as are granted to themselves. This means that each is placed under the supreme direction of what he calls the general will, the idealized expression of equal liberty. So the limit and rights is not hierarchically specified, not vertically specified by a sovereign dictate. It's horizontally specified by I have as much right as I'm equally prepared to grant to you. And it's determined amongst ourselves, not by some hierarchical sovereign figure. The notion of the general will refers here to the will of the sovereign. But by the sovereign, Rousseau means the people understood as free and equal beings. This concept of the general will, expressing the principle of maximum equal liberty, is established as the fundamental law of the modern state. Once the principle of equal liberty is acknowledged as the fundamental law in Rousseau's world, the concept of law is transformed. Rather than conceiving law as imposing a restriction on freedom, law is the command of the sovereign, well, the less we have of the commands of the sovereign, the freer we are. Rather than conceiving law that way, law becomes an expression of freedom. The objective of the foundational political pact, Rousseau suggests, is to transform humans from, this is Rousseau speaking, stupid and bounded animals into intelligent beings. Since this can be achieved only by acting in accordance with the basic law, he goes on to say that whoever refuses to obey it must be constrained to do so. But this, he says, means only that they will be forced to be free. Obviously, I'm going to come back to that when we come to the revolution. Having specified the basic law, Rousseau identifies its operative principles. Sovereignty expresses the general will, the realization of the basic law, and the exercise of sovereignty cannot be transferred, represented, or divided. Sovereignty, therefore, runs through the entire order. It cannot be possessed or represented by any agent, and it stands only as an expression of the autonomy of the political, the autonomy of this distinctive world view. Laws, he explained, are nothing but the conditions of civil association. The people who are subject to them are their author. Any state ruled by laws is of its nature a republic, and every legitimate government is republican. The Constitution is therefore analogous to the organism of a living body. It becomes a unity only in the synthesis of individual decisions and actions which encompass the entire complex of institutional orders. Now, we should note here that Rousseau is not concerned with positive law. He is seeking to specify what he calls fundamental laws, political laws, droit politique, political right. These, he says, are the laws that regulate the action of the entire body acting upon itself. That is the relation between the sovereign and the state. Now, Rousseau disagrees with Montesquieu about method, but he follows Baudin in recognizing the distinction between sovereignty and government. Sovereignty is the exercise of that legislative power. The legislative power is to establish the general will. Government is the officers responsible for the execution of the law. It seems to me that what Rousseau is saying is all of what we lawyers study as law are executive acts. They are acts, whether they're laws of a legislature, they are acts that are seeking to give expression to the overarching fundamental law, equal liberty, the general will. So for Rousseau, the fundamental law is that principle of equal liberty. Everything else is executive. In Baudin, we see that during this early modern period, he tries to provide an account of the authority of the sovereign ruler's power to make law. Montesquieu had sought to provide an account of the fundamental laws of the political domain, derived from the practices of what works, in order to try to strengthen, from historical and empirical analysis, the authority of that world view. Rousseau has a similar objective to Montesquieu, but rather than trying to distill it from practice, he seeks to explain the logic of political legitimacy, by showing how the fundamental law of the political domain seeks the realization of equal liberty in conditions of solidarity. This is a conception of the political domain as constituted by its own autonomous principles of justification. This, then, I think, is the great achievement of these jurists, and I regard them all as jurists, whether legally trained or not, these jurists of the formative period. The challenge is to show how their work guides the formation of modern nation states, and in Rousseau's case in particular, how we might move from the virtual to the actual. Rousseau offers little guidance on how these principles can be made a reality. He does offer some. I'm not denying for one moment that in his studies of political economy, on constitution of the government of Poland or Corsica, he does not make this effort. But most of his work keeps at the level of the rationality of the principles. This, in The Social Contract, is the challenge that Rousseau finessed with his remarkable figure of the lawgiver. And it's this challenge that's taken up and directly faced in the French Revolution, and that's the subject of the next lecture.